taping, dude.
Fantastic. Welcome to Mustard A&A's. I'm Matt.
I am Richard.
And we, every week or so, talk about things in the entertainment industry that strike our interest, that strike our fancy.
Exactamundo.
And actually, I don't know if we're going to get the full hour or so this week.
We can gab. We'll see where we go.
We'll see what happens. First on the list, The Da Vinci Code, which perhaps you're not aware of, was turned into a movie and released this weekend.
Really?
You know,
was that a book or something?
It, in fact, it was. I was interested in seeing it.
I was too until I started seeing the reviews.
And then the reviews just hammered it. I mean, the one our friend Mark sent us, the New York Times review, where the guy just rips on Dan Brown's prose.
Yeah.
And it's funny because reading the book, I don't recall thinking that his writing style sucked.
Yeah.
Because I'm a pretty non-discriminating reader. And it was an effective page turner.
What's interesting, the book got pretty good reviews when it first came out. Before it became the phenomenon, people said, this is a great, you know, basically a page turner. They didn't put it down, but now
I think the reviewers are pissed that if America's going to get excited about a book, why can't they get excited about a well-written book, I think is what people are getting pissed at. But
yeah.
Anyway, so I'm still interested in it, but my need to see has deflated.
Oh, yeah, it's clearly at this point a DVD movie. I didn't see it on the first weekend. It's hard. I just clearly tend to not see these things. And it was interesting, though, to read their reviews. You got this sense that they were, I mean, if it was going to be good, they were going to say it was good. But if it was even remotely not good, everybody was going to hammer on it. And I think that's kind of what happened. My sense is the movie is okay. And because it's okay, the critics are destroying this thing. I mean, they're like angry at the movie. So I don't know, but it definitely deflated my interest. It's kind of pathetic how much critics will affect my desire to see a movie. But simply the fact is, there's a lot of critics I trust, and if a consistent number of them sort of don't like the movie, and Roger Ebert, I mean, he clearly hated it because he gave it 3 stars. So you know it sucks. So anyway, I mean, I was interested, but the movie made a mint. It made like $225 million over the weekend worldwide.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, I mean, I don't even watch TV, and I could not escape the promoting of this movie. It was everywhere. I've never seen a movie as hugely promoted this movie, so it's not a surprise that it made as much money as it did.
And I'm driving over here this morning, and I pass a couple of churches on the way, and there's one with a vinyl banner, you know, just Da Vinci Code discussion, you know, 8 a.m., 9:30, whatever. And I'm thinking, that's a vinyl banner. Those cost $100 bucks or so. You know, it's not...
Did you read the New Yorker? They had the most incredible article about the marketing of this movie.
No.
And they're pointing out that tons of these anti or controversy Da Vinci Code websites, church discussion groups, everything else, you know who's behind them? The movie company. They're the ones that knew that there was going to be controversy, so they decided they wanted to own the controversy. So they're the ones marketing it, making up like there's a controversy, but at least being able to control it a little bit. So I wouldn't be surprised if the marketing company was the one that sent out, here's how you can discuss this movie in your churches, and sent out vinyl banners. I wouldn't be surprised.
Because okay,
they know,
well,
it was going to be, I mean, they know that it's going to draw people into churches. They know that it will cause people to see the movie. I mean, it was just, I honestly wouldn't be surprised. It's pretty Machiavellian, but the whole article said they're spending millions of dollars to market this to churches and marketing the controversy.
Well,
it's incredible.
I mean, and if you're a church, that's how you do it. You discuss it. You don't just out of hand dismiss it.
Yeah,
that's the smart thing to do. It reminds me of when Dogma came out, and there was all these protests against Dogma and Kevin Smith, and it's heresy and blah blah blah, and you know, Kevin Smith goes and, you know, he joins one of the protests against the movie. He's like, yeah, Dogma is dog poop.
Yeah.
He holds a sign. He's talking with the people that haven't seen the movie, don't really know anything about it, but they were told to show up and protest against it. And it's really quite entertaining as he's discussing his movie with these people that have no idea, clearly, that he's the creator. And it's actually, when you take a step back, it's an interesting commentary on, you know, people's willingness to get upset about something, especially religion-based things. Anyway, so that's The Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, I'm not interested that much anymore. You know, I don't know, maybe I'll see. If my dad says, hey, let's go see a movie, I'd probably go with him, but no other reason particularly.
Yeah, and as we normally do here, in no particular order. Mm-hmm. Next up on my list, the Star Wars DVDs.
Oh, yeah.
We discussed last time, or the time before that, that they're releasing the original three Star Wars films on DVD without them being the special editions with the added scenes and whatnot. And then I'm checking the Digital Bits, which is my favorite DVD site, and they find out that they're non-anamorphic transfers.
Yeah.
And as the guy said, and suddenly my interest in this plummets through the floor.
Well, you remember I was mentioning to you, I was saying, you know, they created a clean copy of all these movies in 97 in anticipation of doing some of the first little bits of digital monkeying, and then they released that on VHS. So when they did all that, that was the original copy that they made. And I was going, yeah, I think that's the version. And I know they've cleaned it up even more since. What I didn't realize was they're not even going to release an anamorphic version. They're not even going to go and do the simple basic thing of taking those original cleanup files and just creating a new anamorphic version. It's stunning.
And anamorphic is when you're playing it back on an actual widescreen TV, it fills the whole TV up without using the bars.
Well no, it's not just that. Here's the thing.
But that's the most accessible.
Understood. This is, from what I understand, this is a widescreen version.
Right, but it's...
What they're doing is, yeah, they're cutting off the top and bottom with just black bars as opposed to having it be stretched. So in other words, they're reducing 30% of the information possible on the thing. In other words, they're ripping off their fans. It's just appalling that they're doing that. It's almost like they're saying, okay, you want it, but we're going to give it to you in the worst, you know, possible way. And it just doesn't seem... It seems classless to me.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, the people that are in, you know, the early adopter movie files are just pissed.
Yeah.
You know, by rights, they should be.
Although on that same Digital Bits you sent me, unbeknownst to me, I didn't realize they're putting out a Apocalypse Now kind of special double disc edition. And I couldn't really find much about the thing, but I'm excited about that because it's one of my favorite movies of all time. It's a brilliant movie, and they did the Apocalypse Now Redux or redo movie that they did a couple years ago, and that was a very interesting movie because they re-edited the movie. They inserted two big scenes that had disappeared that had never been in the original movie. One awesome, one less awesome, but both kind of cool to see in the context of this movie. And then they released the movie, and it had no commentary track. Now, Coppola puts out great commentary tracks. The Conversation, Godfather, all of versions of The Godfather.
I don't think I've listened to any of his commentaries on The Godfathers.
They're pretty good. It's really interesting. It's especially interesting to hear a movie that wasn't that successful, Godfather 3, to hear him talk about the challenges, what was going on. And, you know, it's pretty interesting.
And God, that movie just gets savaged by everybody. Yeah. And I don't recall it being that bad. Not as good as the
It's not that
two.
Great. It was nominated for 9 Academy Awards. But, yeah. But, you know, the interesting thing, listening to the first one, is how painful of an experience Godfather 1 was for him. He was savage while he's making that movie. The movie company, I think, is Paramount, had no interest in him as a director. They hated that he was making this movie. They would not let him hire the actors he wants. It was an awful, and you just hear listening to him, you hear it all coming back to him, what a painful experience that was. And then, of course, by the time Godfather 2 rolls around, what an awesome experience it was because he could make the movie he wanted. It's just really interesting. So I'm hoping this new Apocalypse Now has some kind of commentary. But even if it has supplemental materials, what it brings to mind, though, is a movie, you know, there's a bunch of movies that are still not out on DVD. Most famously, one of the best movies ever made, Red, still not out on DVD. And they're playing it on Showtime or HBO the other day. And I was like, oh my God, I hadn't seen it in 15 years. And my God, does that movie hold up? So, but another movie that still isn't out on DVD is the movie that was done using his wife's film diaries of the making of Apocalypse Now. It's a movie called Hearts of Darkness or Heart or something like that. And it is an awesome movie all about the making of Apocalypse Now, the megalomania of Coppola. It's an awesome movie and it's never been on DVD. It's just like, I can't wait for that thing to show up. And if we're lucky, they'll squeeze it in on this DVD. Anyway, I digress.
That's cool. And then somewhat related, I just read that they're prepping the next round of James Bond movies to be released again.
Yep.
On DVD.
How many times do you think they've released the whole set in some form, like some new form? At least three times, I think.
See, because I don't actually have any of them.
My buddy has them all, right?
Yeah, my buddy John, who's a Bond freak, has them all. Yep. So whenever I get the urge, I just borrow one of his. But, you know, I think it sounds like they're doing new supplemental material.
Yep.
So, you know, there's somewhat of a reason there. But the big deal is they're using the what's called 4K scans.
Yep.
Which is basically they go back to the original print negative, and they're using computers to scan every frame with 4,000 lines of information, which by way of comparison, you know, we're starting it in HD, 720p is 720 lines of information, 1080p is 1080.
Yeah.
That 1,080 lines of information all presented at once. But all of which are still lesser quality than what you get looking at a print film like in a theater. But people have said, well, how much resolution do you need to equal print film? And the answer is about 4,000 lines.
Yep.
So we're getting to the point now, they're scanning this stuff at a quality that is indistinguishable from film.
Yep.
And so that's their source material for these Bond films. And they've had some company like in Silicon Valley scanning these things for years.
Yep.
It's nuts. So, I mean, these are going to be definitive quality discs, although I'm not sure if that what's actually on the DVD will be visible at 4,000 lines in the future.
Well, it's one of those things where it's going to make the DVD. I mean, the simple fact is the DVD is not going to look that much better, but if you start with better source, it's going to be that much slightly better. But what they're gearing up for is HD and other methods of distribution. Also distribution back into the theaters when those things come out, you know, the video projectors. I always liked how the Bond franchises worked. I mean, they're one of those franchises. They could have released all those DVDs as is, and they went back and tracked down as many damn directors as they could, all the way from the 60s, to do commentary tracks. And it's cool to see, I mean, I don't know which one, but like Dr. No, and find the old director talking about making the movie. And especially considering these movies are so famously director independent, you know, you
right.
never know who directed, but actually directors put some real energy into these movies, and it's cool to see them pull them out and try and do and get commentaries. I always like that. I mean, the Broccolis are just obviously the most horrible people in the world for how
they
say
obviously. I'm not sure people would understand what you mean by
well,
that.
Well, the family that owns the franchise of them and on every step of the way seems to tick off the fans by making decisions that seem to go against what people really want, in theory.
Well, as you know, this has been one of Jeffrey Wells's big campaign. Well, not big campaigns, but every time he mentions Bond,
yeah,
he brings us up where it's, you know, they keep making Bond more about big explosions and about tech and how cool would it be to, I mean, so Casino Royale looks like actually a step in the right direction where they're pulling back
exactly.
and making it more character driven.
Let's hope.
But, and yeah, and that, you know, Brosnan was a little sort of famously saw things a different way than the Broccolis. He wanted to go back in that,
but they never did. They went as bad as ever. He ended up being not a whole lot different in my eyes to Roger Moore. He was suaver than Roger Moore, but it still was more of the same. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on. Anyway, but 4K transfers is very cool.
Absolutely.
And it's and until they get into the whatever they're doing with the 3D, because like James Cameron is supposed to be filming his next couple projects in 3D, and Lucas has said they're looking at, you know, releasing the Star Wars stuff with 3D technology. And on one hand, I think that's really cool. On the other, I'm like, that's...
I hate 3D. I hate it. But even watching like a movie that was designed for it, like the Polar Express, where they took the elements and created it in IMAX, it just made my... It gives me headaches. I don't understand why periodically certain filmmakers get infatuated with that. Although, you know what they're doing with the new Superman movie? They're doing it in IMAX, and they've given Bryan Singer, they said, listen, we can't do the whole movie. Pick 20 minutes of the movie, any 20 minutes you want, and we'll do it in 3D. So when the new Superman comes out, what they're going to do is whenever he becomes Superman, so it's like through his eyes or when he's around Superman, you put on your goggles and you're watching it in 3D. Now, I think that's the ultimate gimmick, but I definitely want to see Superman in 3D because he filmed this. Remember, he filmed this with It's not filmed on film. He went all digital on this movie, and they went out and got these unbelievably fantastic experimental digital cameras with Panavision lenses. And it's the, and Panavision of course has made Super 35 and the original 70 millimeter lenses. And they made cameras just for this movie. The first ones out there. And he says, damn, it looks as good as 70 millimeter basically.
So do you think Superman vision includes looking at ladies in their underwear?
We can only hope.
It's that X-ray vision,
that,
friends.
That would be funny to like have the glasses in your hands and then look up the screen and some lady's wearing her regular clothes and then pull the 3D lens off and suddenly she's naked. But anyway, so I think it's I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to Superman.
That's the best thing ever.
And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it in IMAX. You know, I just think it's kind of an awesome way to see
film,
it.
The last film I saw in IMAX was Matrix Reloaded.
How did that come across?
It was nice.
With IMAX, I need to sit in the back. I don't need to be enveloped
middle.
Yeah, I end up losing too much information.
It was nice, but it wasn't. I don't recall feeling like, oh, I need to do this every time. Spend another $10 to see the film again.
Well, I was thinking specifically with this one because it's filmed at a very high resolution in an all digital world. Yeah. And it's Superman, for God's sakes. You want him to be bigger in life.
Okay. Next on my list, Transformers.
Transformers.
Nothing really
robots
new.
Robots in disguise. Isn't that the song? Did you watch that when you were a kid?
Why, yes, I did. And
so you're
I don't
younger
need to
than
ever
me.
Hear you sing that again, ever.
I it's definitely, I was like, I can't remember how old I was. When was that out?
80s, like early 80s.
Okay, so
maybe
I wasn't
not early
that.
80s, mid 80s.
Mid 80s. So I was like in high school. So I probably surfed across
I mean,
it.
I friggin' loved it.
Really?
I mean, the show with the toys and da-da-da-da-da-da. But, God, I even have the Marvel comic book, which they're, as I recall, sucked.
Are there actual characters, or is it just robots that become something else?
No, they're characters with personalities.
Okay, because that's what I'm wondering about making this movie, if it's like that.
Well, and it sounds like it's one of those things where it sounds incredibly hard to bring to the screen with any sense of credibility.
I'm going to guess
when it's a cartoon aimed at 10-year-olds, you have a lot more latitude to be completely dysfunctional.
Well, I'm going to guess that it is a movie that is going to have a big budget that's independently financed.
Well, it's Michael Bay.
Oh, Michael Bay. Oh, that's right. I knew that. Okay.
He bought Digital Domain.
Michael Bay bought Digital Domain?
I didn't read the details.
Christ.
I just saw the headline, so I don't know if it's a holding company or what.
I was going to say that the thing about the thing about Transformers is it struck me as similar to Around the World in 80 Days and what was the movie? Oh, Thunderbirds. Go Thunderbirds. Where they spent like $100 million of this money and no studio would pick it up. So they ended up getting like some rich guy to finance it because he's going to make a mint on it. Of course, lost his shirt on those things because it seems like such a lame property that you have to spend a lot of make on it. But the likelihood of it making money. I mean, who's the audience for Transformers?
Well, it's the nostalgia. It's men in their 30s.
And since when
early 30s that grew up with this.
And since when? And you're going to make a live or like a computer animated version of it? Or what is it?
Oh, no, it's live action, but with, I guess, CGI.
Boy, I'd say it, but that's okay. That's $1 million you're going to make. Now, what about the other 150 you need to make?
I don't know.
It seems like the craziest decision.
How do you come
decision?
Up with the justification? I mean, that was, you look at it now, what's the justification for these robots to turn into a car or whatever?
I always think back to that scene in Big where,
when you're a kid, you don't care because it's cool. When you grow up, you're like, what was the point of that again?
Yeah.
But go back to your Big.
Well, you remember when in Big, when they're in there examining toys and they've got buildings that transform into robots and he's pointing out they're buildings that become robots that become buildings, and he's trying to point out how dumb it was, and it was obviously a
That's
dig at
right. I forgot
Transformers
about that.
And so.
Well, I mean, with Transformers, if it's a robot that turns into a car, both of those are cool. You can do stuff with a car.
True.
Building's just going to stand there.
This is true.
But you know what's fun, which I did a couple weeks ago? Go back on the internet and try and find some scans of the early toy catalogs for Transformers. It's like, oh, I remember that. And wow, what was the point again of a robot that turns into a locomotive? What? But it's, you know, it'll be really interesting to see if they pull this off at all.
Yeah.
And then again, you're right. will enough people want to see it beyond the nostalgia crowd?
Yep. Yeah.
But I just, it's fascinating. Next up on my list, Lost, coming to a season two finale coming up.
They going to answer all the questions?
Actually, the promo said all your questions will be answered.
Oh, right. Yep. Okay. Let's just place bets on all of the questions and what percentage will be answered. I'm going to guess 10%.
As I've said in the past, Lost has done a really good job of answering some questions while simultaneously presenting new ones.
Well, they sustain, at least unlike basically like 24 for me and specifically Twin Peaks, which petered out about 11 shows into their first season. This one has sustained it pretty well for 2 years.
They did an amazing job sustaining interest and presenting new challenges. Really an amazing job.
Of course, I haven't seen it since last year, but I've been debating about just buying the whole damn thing on iPod and plowing through.
Well, ABC shows are now free for download.
Oh, that's right. You stream them, so you got to watch them.
So you have to watch the advertising.
Yeah, but no, maybe I could just sit down and watch it that way.
No, to me, it's worth it. I mean, it's really well done. And I remember reading that one of the early ideas was that they were only going to do 2 seasons and then wrap it up and do a movie.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anything about that in, like, I don't know, almost a year. And
chance they're going to do that, considering they're making probably $150 million a year on this show.
Well, the original idea was, I think that it was, you know, it's got to be really hard to write the show and come up with new stuff and keep it at this level. And
so I thought there's this powerful impetus called money that is forcing them to just keep pushing.
Well, it all depends on who actually holds the rights and controls things, because it's not always the studio or the network, which is one of the reasons.
It's a top 10 show, right?
I actually have no clue what the ratings are.
I'm pretty sure it's top 10 show. I could hardly imagine. I can't think of a single series in the history of television that, except for ones that are at the very end of the run and there's other stuff going on, but 2 seasons in, top 10 show would just give up because they just don't want to do it anymore.
And you're probably right, but it depends on who's in charge. And I don't know who's in charge of this show, but and the reason I mention it is you look at something like Futurama, where Matt Groening had creative control.
Yeah.
And I think he owned the property. Fox didn't own it. They just distributed it.
Yep.
Which is different than their Simpsons arrangement. And so that was one of the reasons Fox was unwilling to continue Futurama and was willing to keep batting it around the schedule so much. They didn't have as much vested interest.
Yeah.
And they're much more willing to kick it to the curb. So if, like, J.J. Abrams or whoever are the ones that have the control, and they're more willing to say, you know what, let's just do these 2 high-quality years and be fine with it.
Yeah.
But you're right. Odds are that's not the case. Odds are somebody that's interested in making money has the rights, and they'll milk it. And so it'll be interesting to see how that happens.
Or somebody wants to make money, we'll buy the rights, buy out the person. To say, we want to keep milking this. If you don't want to do it, that's fine. We're going to pay you X dollars so we can keep milking this.
And, you know, the cast and crew like, oh, no, make us film in Hawaii another couple of years. That's horrible. that is really got to be one of the easier shoots.
You would think, but, yeah, they definitely party over there.
Just in terms of it being fun.
Did they kill Michelle Rodriguez?
They did.
Oh, good. I don't watch the show, so I don't know, but it was like, you wonder how much of that was they were always planning to do it. I mean, I've heard she's a very difficult person to be with, or how much of it was planned before she had her drunk driving thing, or if any of that's related. You wonder if they're going, you know, we don't care how she is. We're not going to kill somebody off who's integral, or if a personal life actually interferes on that. What's your sense on that?
I have no idea.
I mean, what was she seemingly important in the show?
She brought an element that wasn't there into it.
Hmm.
I was growing to dislike her less.
Yeah. Oh, really?
That's a convoluted way of saying I was growing to like her a little more.
Yeah.
Anyway, great show.
Yeah.
Fantastic
show. I like J.J. Abrams.
Next up on my list, An Inconvenient Truth.
Oh, yeah, the Al Gore thing.
This is the Al Gore documentary about climate change, and it's picking up a lot of buzz. It got screened at Cannes.
Yep.
Lots of people are seeing it. Almost everybody is is fervently in favor of it, saying this is a fantastic movie. Al Gore does such a great job of presenting the issue and not being preachy and not being boring and not being depressing and saying, you know, it's a call to action. Here's what we need to do.
That depressing part is a hard thing for me. It's kind of funny, but...
Because you look at... Did you see the trailer for it?
Yeah, I did.
And I don't... The trailer really paints it. This is the most terrifying thing you're going to see. And it's like, I wouldn't market it like that.
See, that was my thing. I was talking to our buddy Mark the other day because there's this speaker coming to town that's going to talk. He's written this book about the oil, you know, overuse of oil and the environment and all this stuff. And he's going, I really want to see it. And I'm going, man, I actually don't want to see that guy. I was thinking... It's kind of profoundly depressing to me. And if I hear one more story about polar bears drowning because they can't get to the next ice flow, that is so unbelievably depressing to me that I'm sort of tuned out to it. And I'm literally putting my head in my sand. It's not that I'm not wanting to do something about it, but it depresses me to hear something. So if this movie is less that and more of a call to action, then I would be all over it. But they're definitely marketing it as doomsday stuff. And I don't know if I'm the only one, but I'm kind of really burned out on the doomsday stuff. I'm kind of getting, and I don't mean in a negative way, I'm meaning it's hard for me to read it anymore. It's hard for me to look at Time magazine when they have be worried, be very worried or whatever they had on their cover.
It's, you know, different audiences, because you and I are pretty plugged into, I mean, nobody has to convince you and I about global warming. We're already on board with that.
So who's this audience? Is this audience believers? Or is this audience people they're trying to get to believe?
Right. Well,
because that was the thing about Fahrenheit 9/11.
Because this is
everything Michael Moore said was, oh, we're trying to get people to. No, his audience was clearly people that already agreed with him.
Well, yes, but Fahrenheit 9/11, at the time, most successful documentary ever. So clearly a lot of people saw the movie.
Yeah, but my sense was it was people. I mean, I went to it on opening day and I went to it again. And the audiences, and of course I'm here in liberal Seattle, but the audiences that were watching that movie were uniformly the hoot and holler, we're coming to be re-energized for our beliefs. And I think that's fine, but I didn't see a whole lot of people being convinced by that movie necessarily.
Well, as I recall, part of the deal with the production company that's put it, or the distributor that's putting out An Inconvenient Truth is, you know, God, I want to say I can't remember now.
Yeah.
Who's doing it, but you know, there's like websites around it and stuff that's supposed to really involve people that want to get involved and foster change. And so, you know, clearly the makers of the film are trying to reach the broader audience.
Yeah.
If the distributors of the film are on board with that, and you have to assume that they are supposed to be, you know, that's great. But to me, that's great, but what needs to happen is politicians need to be brought in, the decision makers that actually write the laws, and you know, things like CAFE mileage standards, and you know, saying, and as you start to look around at things like, you know, there's a lot more talk now about, ethanol, a lot more talk about, you know, fuel cell cars, regardless of feasibility. It seems to me like in the mainstream, there's a lot more talk about it. And I think that's good.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're sort of wandering into politics again.
Well, I'm definitely interested in seeing this movie. I just hope it's not one that's going to make me feel queasy through the whole thing. Because I'm not, because honestly,
Heard, it doesn't do that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It's upsetting.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not depressing. It doesn't leave you coming out mopey.
Who is this? Was this the Jarecki or who made this movie?
Not Jarecki.
I
don't think I've heard of them.
Oh, yeah. So it's funny. It's being billed totally as an Al Gore thing, but in reality, it's somebody else's movie that he's the star of, right?
Well,
or is Al Gore
producing? But it's based on this presentation that Al Gore has been giving for years.
It's with him. So
yes, okay. It's very collaborative. Anyway, I'm really,
if I hear him one more time, if I hear the quote, oh God, it's driving me nuts. Hi, I'm Al Gore, and I used to be the next president of the United States. If I hear that one more time, I'm going to choke somebody.
All right.
It's not his fault. They just that's his line, and then they show it every clip when they show this thing.
So as we continue with our Wells Fest, he put it, Jeffrey Wells, who is Hollywood-Elsewhere.com, he's like my favorite online Hollywood guy / reviewer.
Mine too.
So that's why we're always bringing him up. he's at Cannes right now, and he got this invitation to see a movie, and he didn't realize what it was at first. He didn't get the joke.
Well, it was a poorly written
right. It's like you please come movie premiere. It's like pidgin English.
Exactly.
And turns out it's for the movie Borat.
Oh, Borat.
Which is Ali G, which is Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yep.
And oh my,
not Sacha Cohen the ice dancer, but Sacha Baron Cohen. The famous British
and
comic.
I was just thinking the other day, I hadn't, what's the Ali G guy up to? And so, he made a Borat movie.
Yeah.
And it, basically this comic went around, did the show for the BBC, interviewing powerful people and celebrities and opinion makers. Is that a phrase?
Absolutely.
And all these great people saying, you know, he's doing this show and it appeals to the youth culture, but really it was a gag, and he's asking all these really inappropriate questions and putting these guys, and it was hysterical because it was a goof.
Well, it's funny to see the ones that didn't play along. They just got mad at him, like Andy Rooney. When he interviewed Andy Rooney, Andy Rooney just started calling him a moron and wanted to kick him out. But my favorite of all time was when he interviewed a drug guy from the DEA, I think it was. And he had all these different drugs and drug paraphernalia lined up on the table. And he asked the guy, what are the effects of marijuana on the brain? And the guy goes, well, it causes, you know, your ability to talk, to slow down. It makes you lethargic. It can lead to permanent brain damage. It can be devastating. What are the negative effects? It was so funny. But the guy's a genius, and Borat in particular is a uniquely, I mean,
well, and it's as part of this show, it's a separate thing. It's like he plays the same guy, Sasha, instead of playing the Ali G questioner interviewer, plays this character called Borat, who is ostensibly from Kazakhstan and he's like exploring the new world. For God, is it for a TV show, or he's a writer?
No, it's for a TV show, and it's like, and it's, you know, horribly filmed. And but he's off there showing Borat visited America, so he's visiting different portions of America.
Oh my God! And some of this stuff is so drop, just literally fall on the floor funny, because it's so. Assuming you're into that type of awkward humor, but you know, he's at like at a fancy dinner party for, you know, Blue Bloods, and he's like, I had sex last night, high five. And he starts describing the positions.
Well, and then he pulls out Polaroids of his wife. But when he went into this country bar in Arizona and puts on a cowboy hat and starts singing a song, and they're looking at him like they're mad, like, who is this moron? But he starts singing this song called Throw the Jew in the Well. Throw the Jew in the well so my country can be free. And they get so into it. It's the most embarrassing thing to be an American, because they're so into this song all of a sudden. The guy's a genius. I can only imagine this show is going to be incredible. This movie.
Yeah, so that's good stuff.
Awesome.
Fast Food Nation.
Oh, yeah, we saw the trailer. It came out.
This, you know, this is a serious book about how bad fast food is.
Well, and the whole industry.
And the industry, and how, you know, it's the conditions in the slaughterhouses are horrible for both, you know, the quality of meat that's going into the food and what happens to it, and the people that are forced to work there.
Yep.
And everything involved in it, and how bad, you know, how unhealthy it is, how bad it is on so many levels. And I've always been meaning to read the book. I've just never gotten around to it.
Yeah, Eric Schlosser. It's a really good, persuasive, incredible, highly readable book.
So they're making a movie about it, but it's not a documentary. It's it's an interconnected storyline movie a la
Traffic
or an Altman film.
Yep.
And so it's got, you know, Greg Kinnear and others.
It's got all kinds of ones. It's got people like Avril Lavigne and people like that in it.
I think apparently, it's Avril.
Avril. And it's got, and apparently they're like all really good in this movie. It's like it looks like my total kind of movie. Although I thought it was interesting, they clearly weren't going to use McDonald's in here, even though the book is all about McDonald's. But so they create a fictitious fast food company called
Mickey's,
which is, and instead of having a Big Mac, it's called the Big One. I mean, it's pretty obvious who they're talking about. And you can tell from the movie, since the trailer seems to pull no punches, that the movie's not going to pull punches. And from what I understand, at the very end, they go into a slaughterhouse just like the book. And apparently it's pretty brutal and putting off a lot of people.
And you really, Well, and you have to wonder who's how many regular people are going to see the movie as opposed to just like PETA heads.
Yep.
And probably I would hope quite a few.
Yep.
And will it change their behaviors? Will they either eat less meat or stop eating meat?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because I don't eat a lot. I used to be, you know, I've gone back and forth between being a vegetarian and for various reasons, you know, I'm not, but I eat very little red meat. Yeah. And I imagine if I see this film, I'll be disgusted again and we'll go back to not eating meat.
Anyway. Well, you know, and I used to, and I'm a vegetarian, but I always have been one of those people that hates the types that let's show somebody something gory because that's all it's going to take. And I'm thinking, I don't think that necessarily works. I think it works for a day or a couple of weeks.
Well, because then you end up with like the line in Pulp Fiction where pork chops taste good.
Exactly.
Hamburgers taste good.
So you end up going like, I'm not so sure. I mean, I'm not opposed to it, but I just think that there's other ways to do it. And I think this whole movie might cause it or might engender some kind of change in people that just showing the gory stuff wouldn't. I'll tell you, one of the things I liked about seeing this movie is I look and I'm going, God, it's got a similar feel. The trailer does to Thank You for Smoking, which came out last month, which was a brilliant movie, again, based on a nonfiction book. And they've created
Now I'm feeling more and more motivated to see that because
it's really funny.
I'm gonna have to make some time.
It's funny. It's really well done.
That's what
and
you
I'm
said.
Going,
it was really funny. And what to you is the funniest movie you've seen in a theater?
Well,
not the best necessarily, but the funniest where you have laughed the hardest.
Two, but number one was Spinal Tap. First time I've seen Spinal Tap.
Really?
And when I saw it the first time,
you saw it in the theater.
It was 1984, and I just got my driver's license. My buddy and I
have to talk about that when you're
so
done.
Well, we went to the Aurora Theater and we saw it, and there was like nobody in the audience. So it was not like we're involved with everybody else. But at the time, and now the humor probably isn't as funny as it would have been when it first came out, but I laughed so hard. There was times I was laughing so hard that I was having trouble breathing. And then the only other time that I laughed that hard was, I think, the first time I saw Airplane, which I don't even really find funny anymore. But the first time I saw it, I was laughing so hard. So since then, Thank You for Smoking was definitely the funniest movie I had seen in the past maybe year, maybe since for the 40-Year-Old Virgin, which I just laughed my ass off.
Yeah, you're right. That was a pretty funny movie, although I didn't see it in the theater. Spinal Tap for me, I didn't see it in the theater. I rented it video, and I remember I saw it with my girlfriend at the time, Erica.
Yep.
And we watched it, and this is probably 94, 95. No, yep. Must have been... God, when did we go out? 94-ish, doesn't matter. And I watched it, and I was like, that was okay. I didn't think it was bad, but not a whole lot of laugh-out-loud moments for me. And over the course of the years, as I've seen it again and again, I've enjoyed it more and more each time. For me, it gets funnier every time I see it. And a lot of that's because I've been I've been somewhat involved in the music industry, and I know how true a lot of that is.
Yeah.
And bands are famous for seeing it and saying, what's funny about that? That's true.
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
When
that's
they get
how
mad, they think it's about them.
Exactly. And so that's interesting that you thought it was hysterical in the theater. And for me, it took a long time for me to develop that reaction.
I think it's
to
that
it.
Thing. It's like to some extent, a movie of its time when it came out in 83 or 84, I think it was. It's hard to believe that movie's almost 25 years old because they started filming the thing like in 81, but it was so funny. I mean, when he was, I can remember the first time I heard him say the phrase, lick my love pump, and just laugh. I mean, just dying. And then them walking, you know, I mean, just all those scenes, them walking underneath that stage in Cleveland and Derek Smalls is going, hello, Cleveland. Hello, Cleveland. And I'm looking, I'm going, they can't, I mean, we're just looking at each other. I can so remember having never seen the movie before and seeing those scenes for the first time and finding them outrageously funny.
And that's why, to me, Rob Reiner gets a lifetime pass. He can
absolutely
make crap for the rest of his life.
He can make as many Norths as he wants,
he can be as political as he wants and engender South Park mocking him mercilessly. Doesn't matter. He made Spinal Tap.
He did. And, you know, he's made other great movies. True. American President, what a great movie. And that was the one.
Did he do A Few Good Men?
He did A Few Good Men. Great movie.
Wow, although, he really translates Sorkin well.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about A Few Good Men, though, although I think it was the, just to digress for briefly, Ebert, I think it was, had the greatest of all comments for what kind of made that movie not as great as it could have been was at the very end of the movie, they're all sitting in this apartment or this house going, how are we going to get that damn Jack Nicholson character? What are we going to do? And then what they do is they say, I know what we need to do. We need to goad him into it. We need to do this and that. And then what they do, like they have the big court scene, like the next scene, and they goad him into it. What would have been so much better is if they had just said, I don't know what we're going to do. And then halfway through the court scene, you see a glimmer in Tom Cruise's eye as he realizes the way to get to him. What they did is they told you 20 minutes advance how the movie's going to end, and then they end it exactly the way they described it. Kind of a dumb thing, but still a really good movie.
Then it's, can they do it?
But, yeah. What great performances. Anyway, okay. I digress.
I think I've said this in the past, but for me, the funniest movie I've seen in a theater was the South Park movie.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because I remember I had just flown back from somewhere. I'd been on vacation or visiting family in Ohio or something. And I came back. And my buddy and I saw it, and we saw it was one the same day we saw that we saw Wild Wild West. We snuck bought tickets to one and snuck into the other.
Jeez, I've never done that before.
Oh, we used to do that all the time, especially back in California. We'd make a day of it and see five films, having paid for one.
I always felt uncomfortable the thought of doing
the
that.
Way some of the theaters were laid out. It was really easy to do, and having worked at a theater, I knew how to game the system. Anyway, I think we saw Wild Wild West first, and thank God.
Yep.
And then we went into South Park, and just that completely cleansed the Wild Wild West experience. But just the falling on the floor laughing, literally the back of my head, right above my, you know, right where your skull ends, just aching because I was laughing so hard. You know, like the piano that said Felcher and Sons on it. And
just when they first started singing that song, and when they go into the Kyle's mom is a bitch, and then they get to the point where they have the African native singing it with their, when they're, they're doing like, they're like, oh my God, there's three movies I can remember in my life where I laughed so hard at one point, I hit the seat in front of me with my head. And that was Airplane, Spinal Tap, and South Park, the movie. And that's why Team America was such a profoundly disappointing movie. I enjoyed it. There's parts that were fun.
And you were expecting,
I was just hoping that I'm going to die like I did with South Park. Right. And I didn't. Yeah. So,
Did you know that they finally escaped prison in Prison Break?
No, I didn't know that. Hang on just a second. We're going to take a pause here for just a second.
Oh, you're killing me.
Okay. We're back from our little sojourn.
Well, I'm still dealing with my cell phone voicemail.
I've turned mine off.
Well, mine was on silent. I went ahead and
I didn't think I'm a bad person.
Well, you got people that necessarily might need to get hold of you.
So Prison Break.
Oh yeah, I was apparently based on the promos, they've finally broken out of prison.
So we can this series disappear now, right? We don't have to ever watch it.
It's supposed to be like 1 year in 1 year breaking out, 1 year on the run was what I read. I still don't care. I watched the pilot, which was like the first half was directed by, I can't remember if it was McGee or Brett Ratner. I watched the pilot and I'm like, don't care.
McGee, Brett Ratner, two interchangeable directors.
Pretty much.
Equally annoying. Anyway. Yeah, I could care less too.
And then sort of tied into that, I was listening to The Treatment last week. I got caught up and listened to five at once at work.
Yep.
And I was listening to, he interviewed David Mamet, who is writing and is very involved in creating The Unit. And listening to Mamet talk about the creative process and how, you know, there's like 140 guys in the world that are like Delta, you know, they're like this sort of Delta Force Special Ops black bag unit, and how they're trying to portray them in a certain way, and how they're really trying to portray the women and the wives in a certain way and do all this really innovative stuff in terms of drama, in terms of being unique and doing it differently. And I'm like, wow, because based on the promos, it looks like shit.
Yeah, it's
excuse me for swearing. You can bleep that out.
Well, speaking of, I don't see why we avoid the explicit rating. Why wouldn't we want to have one there? There's so many great podcasts out there that people
because you get on a swearing roll, you start in your monkey effers. It's really quite gratuitous.
Well, I could avoid
if
the
you
monkey
can
rolls.
If you can try not being gratuitous, I suppose
but
it'd be
I
okay.
I enjoy monkey effing. It's part of my being. I mean, you're asking me to. I'm sorry. I'm just going to rambling. But anyway, you know, it shows in terms of the unit, it shows how any movie can be reduced to a really bad element in the wrong hands. I mean, you could have Citizen Kane and reduce it to like a newspaper baron and his battles with his wife or something stupid like that. And the unit, I mean, it's a classic case. Everything he's describing was not the show they were promoting in any way, shape or form.
Right. Because it's very, what they're promoting, the promotions I've seen, very action oriented, very, look, they're going to blow crap up, or a member of the unit is captured. It's very serious. Or I think the corniest line for me is like Robert Patrick, and he's like, you shouldn't be here. It's too dangerous to, I don't know if it's wife or this girl he's screwing with. And she's like, and she takes off her shirt and starts making out with him. Is this dangerous enough for you? And it's just so corny. And you're like, oh my God, when did it turn into Cinemax?
Yeah.
And so it's really,
watch your glasses, dude.
It's really interesting to hear Mamet talk about it and compare that with what you actually see in the promo.
I know, and it's Mamet. You're going, God, didn't he have some say in how they promote the damn thing? I mean, he's Mamet.
I don't think they actually do, because a lot of times you talk about, like, Joss Whedon and Firefly. And I remember when Firefly was first being promoted on Fox, because it was, they were going to put it in the same time slot as The X-Files. Yeah. I think it was Sunday at 9.
Yep.
And I was an X-Files fan right up until the end. And I remember thinking very derisively about, oh, this is, I'm not going to be happy, you know, because I'm not going to be happy with anything that replaces the X-Files, even if it's still not as good as it used to be, blah, blah, blah. And I remember the promos were like, you know, there's the captain, there's this, and what's up with the girl in the box? Oh, and I remember Joss Whedon's talking on his commentaries, and Joss, the commentaries on Firefly are great, especially when he's interacting with Nathan Fillion. They're hysterical. But anyway, he starts talking about how Fox promoted the show, and he was pissed because they gave away the fact that what was in the box was the girl, and that was like a big reveal in the pilot, and he was pretty pissed about it. And so I think creators have no say, unless they have creative control written into their contract, which is pretty rare, over how their stuff is promoted.
Well, you know, in the new Wired magazine, they have a big interview with
Singer.
With Bryan Singer, and he mentions pretty clearly that he's involved in every aspect of everything promoting Superman. And he was listing all of this stuff, how he is working on everything. And he even mentioned from the Got Milk ads, as he pointed out, to that documentary we were talking about last week about, I mean, he's involved in all of it.
And what's interesting, I mean, it clearly the studio is placing an enormous amount of faith in Singer
trust,
because he's got this gigantic budget, and a lot of it has to do with Singer himself.
Yep, exactly. And his track record.
And that's amazing. And in fact, I just saw a blurb that he might not be directing Logan's Run now.
Really?
Which is, to me, pretty depressing, because I was really interested in his take on it.
Yeah.
Because he wants to take, like, some time off before having to dive into Superman 2.
Yeah.
Which, clearly, he's on board with. Anyway. But
then again, if he's taking that amount of energy into it, then it sounds like he probably had a lot to do with that Entertainment Weekly cover, which doesn't bode well.
Anyway, my last thing on my list, which is so completely random.
Yep.
We were talking about Michael Mann last week, and you had mentioned that nobody ever mentions Ali.
Yep.
It's like it dropped off the face of the earth.
Exactly.
And I was thinking the same thing with Spielberg and AI.
Yeah.
Have you noticed? Nobody mentions AI ever. It's not held up as anything good or bad. It's not even held up as anything bad. It's just like everyone collectively agreed, let's pretend it never happened.
I swear I'm one of the only people who really liked that movie.
I liked most of it. That 10-minute ending was nauseating.
I didn't even find the 10-minute ending.
That whole
nauseating.
Alien and its fro. Maybe, I don't know. I've only seen it the one time.
Yeah, I don't know. I liked a lot of
it. I was expecting a different film than what I got.
It's interesting. I suspect Munich is going to have the same place because it did well, but it didn't do Spielberg well. It made like $100 and some million. And so I suspect it's going to end up having a same place. It was a brilliant movie, but it's going to kind of disappear. Well,
you know, and I've said this before, although I think it was one in one of our podcasts that is pre being posted.
Yep.
My buddy John and I went to see AI. It was a preview screening. We saw it at Pacific Place. So it was, you know, a very nice theater downtown Seattle, big screen, perfect conditions, and it's over. And he and I look at each other and say, boy, wow, you want to see the Fast and the Furious? Yeah, I want to see that. We had this reaction, that this intellectual thing that just fell flat. We wanted to see this car racing movie.
Yeah.
Which actually reminds me, have you seen the previews, the trailers for Tokyo Drift,
Fast and the Furious 3? Have you read some of the AICN commentary on that, though?
No.
They've had like three different people write in and say, and you're getting the sense that Knowles is kind of agreeing with these people. They're saying, wow, this movie really sticks it. Now that they're Paul Walker independent or whatever, well, they're saying it's actually pretty good.
I mean, because, yeah, they're not using Vin Diesel or Paul Walker.
Yeah.
And the trailer, the trailer, you're just like, it's this new thing. It's drifting. It's basically new, you're skidding.
New thing 10 years,
exactly.
10 years ago.
You know, and there's like, dude, if you're not out of control, you're not in control.
Yeah, it's the same old stupid stuff.
That is, how could, my God, if I'm a brainless high schooler, even then I'm realizing that's a retarded line.
Yeah.
That is so over the top.
But that's the way these movies are. I confess, I liked the second movie.
I liked the first one. I liked the second one. I don't own either of them.
They're dumb. Unlike, are you dissing me there? Actually, I don't know if I own the second
one. You own a bunch. Well, I understand your reasoning for owning a lot of the films that you do. And I don't judge you.
I've got a soft spot for John Singleton. He does occasional good movies, and I enjoy listening him talk about them. But
this thing just looks so retarded, and especially, like, I have a bunch of friends that are really into racing.
Yeah.
Like Formula One racing, which is it's the top of the heap worldwide racing, where all the money and the technology is. And it's really unpopular here in America.
I know, but it's unbelievably popular in the rest of the world.
Right. And so, you know, these friends and myself, I wasn't into F1 before I started hanging out with these guys, but I never liked NASCAR. This whole accelerate and turn left thing, I've never understood the appeal with that. But same thing with drifting. They're extremely derisive, like, excuse me?
Yeah,
I mean, like, yes, there's a certain amount of skill in getting the car to skid like that, but so what? It's got nothing to do with racing. It's got nothing to do with skill and coming in first. It's all about showmanship.
Exactly. I confess, I bought Need for Speed Underground for the PC, and a bunch of the tracks in there, you have to drift, and of course you get how you make points is by the longest drift. And what sucks is at a certain point you realize just how to do a drift. You're not winning, you're not doing anything. You're just skidding for a very long time. But I confess it's actually really a lot of fun to drive.
Oh, it
that
can
way.
Be, but to build a movie around it as a new style, or especially when, as you point out, it's 10, you know, it's years old. This is not new.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe to Ma and Pa Kent,
yep.
It's new, but, you know, to young people,
yeah,
they've been aware of drifting for a while.
Yeah, for quite some time.
I don't know. It's just,
I don't know. The guys that saw it said, hey, this movie was really exciting. It was well done.
And when you buy the DVD, if it's not too scratched to play in my player, I suppose I'll borrow it.
Okay.
All right. I'm done with my list. Do you have any new DVDs to?
You know, I actually think I did not purchase. Did I purchase any DVDs?
I don't see anything. Usually they're stacked up.
Nope. No new DVDs. Wow, what is going on with me? Maybe I've turned over a new leaf. Oh, I know. I bought a friggin' iPod, so I didn't have much money left over. So.
I gotcha.
So I downloaded. I signed up for. I went ahead and bought the ridiculous. I could probably, actually, this is one case where it's cheaper on iPod. I bought the season 5 of The Shield because somehow, because I don't watch much TV anymore, I was waiting. God, when's the Shield gonna come on? And I'm flipping the channels one day, and there's the Shield, and it's the season finale, and I had missed the entire season.
Do you understand that maybe you could look that up on the internet?
I don't know. In the old days, I would watch a lot more TV, so I'd be more aware. And in this case, I missed it, so I downloaded the whole season. So now I'm gonna watch that, and it was like $20, which is good because they charge like $50 for the season on DVD. It's one of those ridiculous ones. For like South Park and whatever, it's cheaper to buy the DVD. But anyway, well, so I download that, and there weren't
my South
things.
Parks on DVD.
I don't either. I was
except for the movie, and the reason is because they've never. If they had started with the commentaries, done full length commentaries with the first one, I would have been on board and would own them all.
But they did with the first one. Don't you remember? They released them separately as a CD.
Well, yeah, and I don't want to screw with that.
And I'm not so sure why they did that.
I think it was a legal thing. Because I want to say Warner Brothers. I don't know where that's coming from. Because I think it's Paramount, actually.
Yeah.
Well, Paramount released the movie. I don't know who owns. Whoever it was that would put out the DVD sets, I think, were very leery about Matt and Trey swearing and carrying on in the commentaries.
Yeah, that's what I
which
heard.
Is ridiculous. But I think if they were to start over again now, they'd do it differently. But they're still really... So now what they do is they're like mini commentaries.
Which I don't want to have anything to
that's
do
that's ridiculous. Yeah. You know what? If you're going to do it, do a full commentary and let them say whatever they want, and then I'll buy it. Yeah. But, you know, putting them out on CD, it's an interesting way of getting around it, and I give them credit for that. But I don't want to screw with that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I did buy a DVD. I just remember I bought the season one of Drawn Together, which I love, and it has commentary, so
my John loves that, and he was pushing me on it, and I've seen an episode or two, and to me, it's I get where they're going for, but with me, they fail.
With me, it works so wonderfully in so many levels. It's just, it goes so far over the edge, and it's so goddamn clever, but that's just me. But anyway, they have commentary, so I'd love to hear what the creators, what they were going for, and especially to hear if there's things that they were not allowed to do, because I'm trying to picture stuff they couldn't be allowed to do, because they so do so many appalling things on this show that it's like, well, what would be worse than this? And I'm looking forward to hearing if they mention anything in the commentary that they weren't allowed to do.
Yeah. All right. Anything else you'd like to speak of?
What's up next week? What's the next movie coming out?
X-Men 3 is next 3. Weekend. That's so we right now we have to make a pact that each one of us will have seen that.
I will definitely see it. I'm going to forewarn you though. Next weekend is the. It's the holiday weekend, and I may be in Canada on Sunday.
Oh, okay.
So we might.
Ooh, that's.
We could do it maybe
Friday
night or Monday.
I forgot about that. We might be up at a friend's.
Where are you going?
We have some friends whose parents have a house on Big Lake up by Mount Vernon.
Oh, cool.
And so we might be camping.
Well, maybe we'll pass you on the freeway. But anyway, we'll have to figure out what day we're doing it.
Yeah,
but I'm definitely going to see X-Men next week.
I forgot how that would. Because isn't. Yeah, Friday's off, isn't it?
No, it's Monday's off. Monday is Memorial Day.
I wonder, because there's a thing at work, and it doesn't matter, people don't care about my work schedule, but I don't know if I'll be able to see it Friday or not.
Yeah.
And the thing about this, and this is sort of relevant, it's a movie like this that has such a broad-based appeal, especially a youth-based appeal, I'm putting more and more thought into where and how I see it.
Yep.
Because I hate seeing films with like high schoolers.
Oh yeah.
It just drives me nuts. Especially and for me the Woodinville Theater is the worst.
Yep. Oh yeah.
I have the worst experiences seeing films there just because there's so many high schoolers and teenagers there.
Yeah, you gotta go at the right time. If school's still in session and everything
and
else
for
you
me,
can go during the day.
It was easier when I had my last job because I had a lot more freedom about when I'd leave, but now it's very hard for me to see films on Friday anymore unless I go Friday night, and that's when everybody's seeing them.
Yep.
And I hate doing that. So sometimes Saturday. Anyway, it's hard. And then I start thinking about with spectacle movies, you want to try and see it on the big screen. So like the new Alderwood Mall Theater, which has like four. It's got two Gigantor screens, like bigger than Cinerama.
Yep.
And then it's got two that are almost that big, which are great. So you want to try and it's like, well, you figure the first screenings of the day are on the big screens and then you're trying to like do the math in your head with the movie times. Okay. 2 hours. And if it's playing every hour, when will I hit the big screen again?
Yeah.
Cause you don't want to go through all the trouble of seeing it with this bunch of punks and then see it on a smaller screen.
Yeah. I
there's
totally
all this,
agree.
Like you think yourself into a hole versus other people are just like, let's go see the movie. Woo. It's like, I'm putting too much effort into it.
So do you want to care to make a prediction on the tomato reader rating of X3? Here's my thinking.
50%.
You're very close to what I'm thinking. I'm thinking 45%, and I'm going to think here's the tenor of the reviews. That some are going to like it, but most are going to go, it feels like an approximation of an X-Men movie, but it doesn't quite deliver. And
to me, I'm not, you know what? I'm not even going to blame Brett Ratner for that. Yeah. I'm really not. And it's because I blame the studio
for hiring Brett Ratner, the world's worst director.
Well, for that, but for letting it get to the point where they needed a director now.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to make a release, because they're trying to make a release date, and everything is based on that, which means they need to make the film in 6 months or whatever, which means they need to start pre-production here, which means they need a director here.
Yep.
And part of the reason Singer went to Warner's to do Superman was because Fox is screwing them around. Like they would not commit to a deal.
Yeah,
for X-Men, they're like, well, we like you, but we're not gonna sign you. And stunning. I think it was, God, I can't remember if it was the studio head or not, but it was like there was some drama there where they just wouldn't sign him.
Yeah.
And so Singer's like, well, you guys are, I like you, I like making the X-Men movies, I like all the cast, but Warner's is going to give me a blank check.
Yeah, and giving him the literally the amount of freedom they're giving him.
Exactly. How could you not turn that?
Especially X-Men, which has been brilliant movies. X-Men has become unbelievably popular in the mainstream because of Singer. Superman is. That is.
And so...
The creme de la creme.
And so the studio who realizes, whoops, we strung along Singer way too long. He's gone now. And they're like, oh crap. We thought we were playing hard to get, and we were still going to eventually get him.
Yep.
Suddenly they're like, whoops. And they're like, well, you know what? People are going to see it anyway.
Is McGee available?
Oh. And so I don't blame Ratner. He's got a certain style and he's going to do a good job or a bad job. But if it fails, it's really, to me, the studio, which was because they're trying to make their release date, and everything is based on that. And it's really not even about making a quality film. It's about pushing a franchise out the door and get the guaranteed money.
Yep.
And so that to me is where I'm falling down on that.
Yeah, I'll definitely see it.
That being said, it's either going to be, Brett Ratner. If Brett Ratner makes a bad movie, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't really blame him that much because he was put in a very difficult position. And I'm really not trying to be a Brett Ratner apologist.
You make a good point. I still will blame him because I hate him. But
especially, because now I'm seeing all the stuff about Rush Hour 3 and Brett Ratner's talking about Rush Hour 3. And I'm thinking, who really cares? Who really gives a flying?
You know what's amazing, though, about that is that, the thing that slows those down is Chris Tucker. Think about all the movies Chris Tucker has been in. Well, let's see. There's that one, like Mama's House or whatever, or Friday or something. And then he's been in Rush Hour 1 and Rush Hour 2, basically.
He was in The Fifth Element,
He was in The Fifth Element. Okay, but other than that.
Super Green!
And you know what's so incredible about him? He realized, wow, Rush Hour 1 was this huge success. So he held out for $20 million for Rush Hour 2, which seemed incredible at the time. Well, Rush Hour 2 made a fortune. So now he's holding out for an even bigger amount for this one. And he's realizing, I just hold out. They made so much money. So it's incredible how much money those movies have made, considering they just seem to me a little throwaway weekend movie.
And you think about it, you're like, $20 million. You literally, you would never have to work another day in your life as a normal person for, a $5 million, a fraction of that.
He kind of is doing that. If you look at it, he's not doing other movies, and they're not asking him to do other movies near as I know. He's just, and I think he realizes if he does other movies, suddenly Rush Hour 3, actually, he won't get as much money. I mean, it's an interesting choice.
You're right.
He's made.
It is interesting.
Anyway, so we should wrap it up.
All right. So let's pump the email address again. If you have questions, comments, concerns, you guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com. Which
questions, comments, concerns, but not spam. Just because we're releasing this over the thing, we don't want to start getting into you with spam.
Wow. What? The guy that was just about to send us spam has now stopped because you politely asked him not to.
Porn spam, it's okay, but we don't want any, we don't want to have your business opportunities sent our way.
Okay, that'd be. And we now have the last three episodes up.
That's true.
So hopefully this one will also
this
be up.
Get up today.
Wow. Fantastic. Thank you, sir. So you guys rock at mustardayonnaise.com. We will interact with you over the, we will respond to what you say.
Exactly.
But you have to be a part of that process.
Through the miracle of teledildonics.
Dude, my mom listens to this.
Sorry.
Can we? Oh, oh my God. Sorry. That was all Richard. I got... Jackass. All right. You should... no, I this is Matt.
And this is Richard.
Malibu. F yeah.
2 weeks in a row.
I know.
Move on.